Keď si zadáte do Google pojem ADHD, vybehne vám 64 miliónov výsledkov. Pritom pred 30 rokmi táto diagnóza vôbec neexistovala. Neznamená to, že by neboli v spoločnosti ľudia s prvkami ADHD, ale skôr, že ju lekári nediagnostikovali. Pritom to nie je žiadna čierno-biela diagnóza. Vlastne všetci máme ADHD, aj ja, aj vy, len sa nachádzame na škále. V niektorých prípadoch môže byť dokonca aj super schopnosťou, ako ju označuje švédsky psychiater a autor bestsellerov Dobehni svoj mozog a Dobrá správa o úzkosti Anders Hansen.
What my book about ADHD is about, it's try to understand how this can be a terrible thing for you, but at the same time it can provide superpowers. People who have ADHD are often very creative, they're more creative than people are in general, and when they find their the thing that they really enjoy, you know, the thing that clicks, and that could be just about anything, they could be incredibly good at what they do.
Moje meno je Lucia Okšová, som novou šéfredaktorkou Forbes Slovensko, no možno ma poznáte ako jednu zo spoluzakladateliek projektu Nevyhorený. V tejto špeciálnej epizóde podcastu Nevyhorený sa rozprávam s Andersom Hansenom, uznávaným švédskym psychiatrom a spisovateľom. Najdlhšie uvádzame na trh jeho piatu knihu Dobrá správa o ADHD, ktorej odhaľuje jednu z najčastejších diagnóz súčasnosti. Budeme sa rozprávať v angličtine, ale nebojte, prepis podcastu v slovenčine nájdete aj v aprílovom vydaní slovenského Forbesu a na Forbes.sk. A pokiaľ by ste si chceli prečítať celú knihu, čo vrelo odporúčam, môžete si ju kúpiť aj na webe Forbes.sk. Link pripájame do popisu podcastu.
In a short time, we are publishing the book about ADHD, which I understood is not your most recent book. It's an older one, but this has become a more of a big topic in Slovakia, and we assume that it will be very popular here as well. But I wanted to ask you, when we last spoke, I think it was March or April last year, you said that you would like to write another book. You don't know what would be the topic about. You were about to shoot your new TV series. So what happened during the past year?
Well, I did a TV series about personality that is just being aired right now in Sweden. And it's about what shapes a human. Why do we become the person we become? And it's a question I have always thought about. And I sort of wondered, how would my life have been if I had lived in another family, if I had lived in another country? Would I have been the same? Would I have been a different person? And in this series, I investigate that topic and I meet identical twins who have been separated at birth and who have grown up in totally different environments and who meet in real when they are adults. And it turns out that they are very similar. They're not identical, but they are very similar. So that's part of this program. Another episode deals with how much we can change personality. And one episode is about psychopathy, psychopaths and narcissists. And another episode is about ADHD and autism. So I've done that. And then I've done a lot of interviews because these books have been published in many countries. And that's very surprising. I'm so happy that has happened. And I'm very surprised.
Is there something new that you learned in the process of shooting the TV series? Something new about personality that you were not aware before, or that really showed you how personality is created in a different light than you thought previously?
Yeah, I guess my main takeaway was that identical twins who are reared apart become very, very similar. In this program, we meet a pair of Japanese men, and they were born in the late 50s, and their mother could not take care of them. The father was not around at all, and they were adopted to the US, and one of the brothers is adopted to Kansas, small town in a rural area, religious family, and his brother is adopted to New Jersey. He lives in a big town, non-religious family, totally socio-economic background. And they become aware of each other's existence when they are in their 30s. And at that point, both of them are gym owners. I mean, what are the odds for that? That's just incredible, I think. And I think that really shows the power of genetics. And these are not the only identical twins. Many of these cases have been studied, and it turns out that they become very similar. So, and from that, the conclusion is that half of personality comes from our genes. And the other half, which is not our genes, is actually not our parents. It's not the environment in the family, but it's random things. And it's also friends more than that. And I was very surprised when I heard about that. I thought, that can't be true. I mean, my parents must have affected me the way I grew up. But the science is very clear that they probably did not do that so much. That's one big caveat, and that is if you have a big trauma in your background, that will affect your personality. But apart from that, it doesn't seem to make so much difference. And for some parents in Sweden, there's been a lot of discussion about this program, and many people seem to be relieved that, you know, you don't have to be this perfect parent that really shapes your child like modeling clay. If you're just okay, the kid is going to turn out fine. He's going to be, or she's going to be what he's going to be. You know, he's going to find his way sooner or later. Sort of my takeaway message for all of that was that there is something that is uniquely mine that doesn't come from the environment. So I would have been pretty much the same regardless of where I had lived. And that means that I'm not just like a leaf that is blown around by the winds of fate. I am something that is unique, that has never been, and that never will be again. And of course, the same is for you and for all the viewers and listeners. Personality is incredibly complex. We cannot categorize personality according to colors or boxes or, you know, you're the analytic person and so on and so forth. It's much more complicated. And each of us has individual personalities. And another takeaway from this series is that it's not that you should try to become a special personality, you should make the best of what you are. So become the best version of yourself, sort of. And I think in order to do that, you have to understand your personality. And that's where this knowledge comes in.
Honestly, for a parent, it's really relieving to hear you say that. And there was also the episode about ADHD that you mentioned. There's some study of twins included as well. What kind of research were you doing during that episode?
Right. I mean, ADHD is a diagnosis which comes from symptoms. So you can't do a blood test and see whether you have ADHD, or you can't do an X-ray or something like that. ADHD means that you have problems with your ability to concentrate, to focus, and you're also hyperactive and you're impulsive. And of course, everyone is more or less of these things, so you should not just be a little of it, you should have a lot of it, and it should cause problems. And not just problems at work or in school, but also at home. And ADHD is very genetic. It's very genetic. And how do we know that? Well, we know that because if we have identical twins and one brother has ADHD, then the chance is very high that his brother will also have, or her sister will also have. But if you have siblings, which are not identical twins, then the chances, if one has ADHD, the chances is much lower than the other one compared to identical twins. So from that, we know that it's very genetic. And in this episode, I meet with a guy who has ADHD. He's a very famous chef in Sweden, and he had a very troubled upbringing. He could not focus at school. I mean, he just wanted to be good, but he couldn't. He did all he could, but he could not pay attention. And since he did not want to be the guy who tries and fails, he became the clown in the class, so to speak. And then he winded up using drugs, and he was actually homeless. His parents kicked him out when he was in his teens, so he lived homeless. And then he finally found his passion, and that was cooking food. And he became incredibly good at that, that he could spend 14, 16 hours in the kitchen, just soaking up everything from the colleagues. And he became a very successful chef, and he has used ADHD to his advantage. So that is very much what my book about ADHD is about. It's trying to understand how this can be a terrible thing for you, but at the same time, it can provide superpowers. People who have ADHD are often very creative. They're more creative than people are in general. And when they find the thing that they really enjoy, you know, the thing that clicks, and that could be just about anything, they can be incredibly good at what they do. And in this episode, we also go to Africa. I go to Kenya, and I try to understand the traits that we call ADHD. Why are they so common, and why are they genetic? Because if they would have just been bad for us, they would have been weeded out by evolution. So the fact that they are genetic and that they are common means that they have probably been very important for humans. And that is exactly also what a lot of studies has shown. And I traveled to this tribe in Kenya who lives like hunters and gatherers. And I tried to understand that kind of personality. What kind of function has it had historically?
You mentioned this tribe also in your book about ADHD. So what is so special about this one Kenyan tribe that is still living as the, I would say, hunters and gatherers, or in those terms that we no longer in the modern society live?
The most important thing I never learned in med school is that the brain has not changed for 10,000 years, or it has at least changed very little. So we are still adapted to a life as hunters and gatherers. And there are a few remaining groups on the planet, and they are no time machine back to our ancestors, but they are probably the closest thing you could get to a time machine. And I went to this tribe in Kenya. They live like hunters and gatherers. They constantly move. They don't have electricity. They don't have any running water. They don't even have matches. And what one has seen when these tribes has been studied is that ADHD is genetic, as I said, and there are many genes that contribute to ADHD. But one of the most important ones is related to a neurotransmitter called dopamine in the brain. And there are different forms of this gene, and which form you have is something that you're born with, so you can't change that. And there is a certain form of the gene which make the dopamine system require more in order to be active. And that probably means that you need more stimuli from the environment. The world is a bit more boring if you have that variant. And that variant is connected to ADHD. It's more common for people with ADHD. And it turns out that the people who are hunters and gatherers and who have this form of the genes, they have more higher body mass index than the ones who don't have the gene. And this does not mean that they're overweight. That means that they are further away from starvation because these people are threatened by starvation. So that can be interpreted as they are more successful in finding food. They are better at hunting, so to speak. But one has also looked at the prevalence of these genes for a group of people who have left hunting and gathering and become farmers. And then it turns out that the ones who have the genes have lower BMI. So they seem to be less successful in gathering food, farming. And perhaps that shows that these traits, you know, being hyperactive, impulsive, constantly scanning the environment, that was fantastic for humans. That helped us survive in a world where we were hunters and gatherers. But that became less advantageous when we became farmers, because as farmers, we have to plan ahead. What crops should I plant for the next season and so on and so forth? So that sort of gives an indication why these traits could have been vital for humans in our history. And that's probably why they are so common. But someone with ADHD might be very sad to hear that you would have been a success story on the savannah 10,000 years ago. Now you're having problems in school. I mean, that's no really comfort. So that's why I think what I bring up in the book is important, that ADHD is connected to creativity and also hyper-focus, actually. When these people find what they really are interested in, they could block out everything else and become obsessed with it. And that's exactly what we saw with this chef in the program. He became obsessed with cooking, and now he has his own TV program and he's very successful in Sweden, and he's not even 25 yet. So when he found his thing, he became a star, but he had problems in school because school is not simply for everyone, you know. And he grew up feeling worthless, and that's why we need to learn more about these traits so that people don't grow up feeling that they don't belong, that they're worthless at their first time in their lives when they are being compared to other people, which is in school, of course.
So I understand it correctly that there were two parts of the tribe, and within one tribe, the ADHD gene, as we can call it, with quotes on top of that, was being more successful, had a higher BMI, and was basically better off because of the ADHD genes. And as you write in your book, if the ADHD-related traits would be all bad or hurtful, we would probably go extinct, right, as a humanity. So everything must have some meaning and some benefit to our existence, including these activities or these traits like hyperactivity and hyperfocus and overstimulation and so on. So I just wanted to repeat that interesting thought. And I'm glad that you brought up the Swedish young chef, the superstar again, since I wanted to ask you, was there something that surprised you about his story, about his path and how he turned his life around?
That's a great question. No, I think he was pretty typical. What he really expressed so clearly was how he wanted to be good more than anything. He wanted to make his parents proud. He wanted to be good in school, but he just couldn't. And he did not want to be the one who tries and fails. No one wants to be that, especially not when you're in your early teens. And then it was better to become the guy who don't try, because then at least you never tried. So how could anyone accuse you of being a failure then? And he took that part as the clown of the classroom. And even though he wanted to be good, and that led him down a path that was very destructive. And he fell into the wrong crowd, and he started using drugs. And of course, drugs affect the dopamine system in the brain. And that's why people who have ADHD are more vulnerable to narcotics. And he became severely addicted and had a terrible life before he managed to turn it around. And I just felt so sorry for him, because I thought if this had been picked up earlier, it would not have had to go through that. So we have to honor these traits better. I think we are squeezing down what we consider normal in society. You know, the boundaries for that is getting tighter and tighter and tighter. And not just in terms of ADHD, but also in terms of autism. I think a lot of human creativity is being lost because people with autism, or who have lots of traits of autism, feel broken, feel damaged. And that's terrible for them, discriminatory for them, but it's also a loss for the rest of us, because these talents are not being, you know, exploited, so to speak. But I want to emphasize that ADHD doesn't come from one gene. There are several genes, but this seems to be the most important one.
When did this chef realize that he has ADHD, or how did he get diagnosed?
He was in his late teens when he became diagnosed, and he was given medication at that time. And then things started working out for him as well.
Was it due to medication? Did it severely contribute to that? I know that this is a topic that you explore, and we will talk further in your book as well, whether medication is overused, to which cases it is very helpful, and to which cases it maybe works as a band-aid.
I'm not sure if that was most important for him, but as a psychiatrist, I can certainly say that medicines can be life-saving for people with ADHD. They could really be the thing that turn everything around, so they could be very, very positive. The problem, I think, is that in Sweden today, in Stockholm at least, 1 in 10 teenagers are being diagnosed with ADHD. So it's becoming very common. And the problem with that is that the ones with the most severe problems, they end up in a line that consists of 10% of their population, and then they don't get the help they need. That's a big problem, because people start seeing ADHD in everyone. They think it's black or white, either you have it or you don't. But in reality, these are traits that are normally distributed in the population. You have more or less of them. And if you have not so much of it, I think you should try to look at the positive sides. Okay, I have these problems, but at the same time, I'm probably good at this. So let's start using that instead of just thinking medication and diagnosis.
What is the greatest myth or misconception about ADHD?
Well, I guess one of them is that it's just a myth, or that it doesn't exist, or it's just something that pharmaceutical companies have made up to sell medication. And those things it's a concrete condition that exists, and it's very genetic. You can't just say to someone, pull yourself up, focus. It's not that simple. I mean, evolution is much more powerful than that. And in the same way that you can't say to someone with a depression, pull yourself up. You can't just say to someone with a diabetes, that pull your blood sugar up. It doesn't work like that. These are very, very powerful states. So those are a big misconception. So,
what about the statement that you can grow out of ADHD, that you can get diagnosed or you can show some signs of ADHD as a child, but once as you get older, you can grow out of it? Is that true or is it a myth?
That's probably true. About half of all everyone's with ADHD seem to grow out of it, or at least it's being reduced so much that it doesn't qualify for a diagnosis. And that's probably because the brain matures, and the part of the brain which is right behind our eyes, this part of the brain, it inhibits reactions. It puts a brake on us, so to speak. It's very important for reducing impulsivity. If this part of the brain isn't functioning so well, you're very impulsive, and that matures late. So some people grow out of it. But we must remember that this is not black and white. ADHD is not something you either have or you don't have. It's a huge gray scale. And the problem is then that where do you draw the line between normal problems of focus and ADHD? And that's is a very tricky question to ask. And that's exactly why so many more are being put on this ADHD side of that spectrum. And of course, by itself, that's not a problem, I think. The problem is that the ones with most severe difficulties, they get pushed out because they normally don't, you know, they're not the ones who will ask for help. They will sort of disappear and do something else.
Why is it so hard to explain to people that ADHD is a real diagnosis, not a made-up one?
That's a great question. I think that we have ignored biology. We think that the brain is just something that's interesting in a laboratory setting or a hospital, but that doesn't affect us. But the brain is an organ. And I remember I was in an autopsy room at the Karolinska. It was 25 years ago now almost, and I held the human brain in my hand for the first time, and I realized that I am closer to this man's inner self than he ever was, in a way. But the big takeaway message from that day was the fact that the brain is an organ. And just like the other organs, the heart, the kidneys, the lungs, the brain has not evolved the way it did by chance. The brain is a survival machine that wants to help us survive, and it doesn't show the world as the world is. It shows us the world as we had to see the world in order to survive. So the brain is not a sort of passive middle step that you could skip if you want to understand human nature, because it is, by definition, what human nature is. So I think this misconception that anxiety, depression, ADHD, they're not the real diagnosis, that misunderstanding comes from what people don't realize, that it's all in the brain. It's happening, and the brain is an organ. And there is a shift now. It's definitely a shift in Sweden where people are starting to realize this, and the stigma is being broken. But these things take time. They don't happen overnight. And I think we will see this shift in many countries, actually. I think we will start acknowledging our biological nature and sort of respect that more, I think. And that's because science is advancing so quickly now, and we're learning so much more about these things. We're learning so much more about ADHD, about the autism, about depression, about anxiety, about what shapes personality and so on. And these eternal human questions that we have just previously just been able to guess. Now we can look under the hood and see what's happening in the brain and why, and understand what different parts of life and understand what role our genes play and so on. And I personally think that that leads to a more humane society, a more forgiving society, where we just don't say, pull yourself up, or, you know, feel calm, or there's nothing to worry about. Sit still in the classroom. Well, it's not really that simple, you know.
Can you see ADHD on an MRI scan?
No, you can't.
You don't. So there is like no physical proof, which can be the reason why it is for some people so hard to believe, because you don't see like a result of a test, right? Or a scan of a brain that shows you like, look, I have diagnosed this condition.
Exactly. And problem, I think, is partly that it is a medical diagnosis, because if you want to know if you have HIV or hepatitis, you take a blood test, and then you can tell whether you have that. You don't have a little HIV. You either have it or you don't. And people tend to look at these diagnoses such as ADHD and autism as well. Either you have it or you don't. And the thing is that it's a big gray zone where you have more or less of it. And another thing that's important is that HIV and hepatitis is just bad. You know, there's nothing positive about that. But these diagnoses also can be very positive. You could have a superpower or unique abilities. So when they are being framed as medical diagnosis, that can itself be a problem, I think, because you underestimate the positive sides of it.
Of course, and also I can just imagine how it decreases the self-esteem of a person like the chef in Sweden who used to be or could be creative, but under the diagnosis or under the persuasion that he wasn't good enough at school, let's say he turned his life completely the other way. And luckily, he was able to do it once again and into the positive side. Let's just roll back and answer the most basic question. What is ADHD? Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. How would you define it?
Well, ADHD means that you have problems with your ability to focus. That's a main symptom. And then you also have problems with hyperactivity and impulsivity. And these are not things that you have for a short period. It's something that you have when you were born. You're born with ADHD. So you've had these problems in school and you have them as an adult. You don't just have them at work or in school, but you also have them at home. There's no blood test. There are no scans. There are nothing like that that will show whether you have this or not. It's purely symptom-based diagnosis.
Yet 30 years ago, the diagnosis didn't exist, right? And now we are talking that 10% of people in Sweden or 11% of young adults or adolescents and children in the US are diagnosed with ADHD. So what happened? Are we better in diagnosing ADHD? Are we narrowing down the definition of normal, as you mentioned at the beginning of our interview, or what happened with us?
There was different names for this. It was called DUMP. Or minor brain dysfunction, I think, something like that, in the 70s. So there has been names for these diagnoses before. Have these symptoms increased? No, they probably have not. The best studies shows that the symptoms of ADHD and autism does not seem to have increased in the population, actually. What has increased is public knowledge about that, so that more people are seeking help and getting help. And I think you're exactly right that we are sort of narrowing down what is acceptable. The normal box where everyone is supposed to be squeezed into is getting tighter and tighter. And that's partly driven by technology, I think. More and more cognitive demands is put on us in order to get into the job market. And that development will probably just continue as artificial intelligence replaces a lot of humans. And the ability to focus, the demands on that will just increase. You know, if you can't focus, you will not get a job. And then you will ask yourself, well, what's wrong with me? And the question, what's wrong with me, that will be framed as, do I have a psychiatric diagnosis? So therefore, I think there's a big risk that the number of people who seek help for this will increase. And that is partly good because it takes away stigma, but the problem, I think, again, is that the ones who have the biggest problems will end up in the last of the line, where 10% of the population is. So these are very, very difficult problems. What I think is sad is exactly what you referred to earlier, that the first time in life when you're being compared to other people, that's in school. And if you don't perform well in school, then you feel that I'm worthless. And then your self-confidence might be, you know, low for life because of that. And that's because school doesn't fit everyone. Everyone is not made for that. And when I was in Kenya with this tribe, I mean, I realized that having a teacher standing, writing things on a blackboard, that's very recent. We just had that for, well, not even 200 years. So that's very recent. People learn more practicing doing things and so on. And for some, maybe that's a better way to learn things. So I'm not a teacher, so I don't want to go too far into that discussion, but I want everyone to sort of understand that if you're not good at these things and if you have problems with your focus, well, maybe there are other things that you could be very, very good at. That could be a superpower.
Let's go a little bit deeper into the concrete aspects of ADHD. You mentioned that it is very difficult for people with ADHD or ADHD traits to focus. On the other hand, they are usually able, or some of them are able, to hyperfocus. How is this possible? It's quite paradoxical, right?
Yeah, that's a great question, and that's a big mystery. And hyperfocus means that you are completely obsessed with something. You sit for 5 or 6 hours and time disappears and you're doing just this thing. And it turns out that what is probably happening is that these individuals need a certain amount of stimuli in order for things to be interesting. But when they found the thing that is enough interesting, nothing else can sort of take away their focus from that, because everything else on the side is not fulfilling enough, so to speak. So it seems like you're unable to shift your focus, actually, if you have ADHD, when you find what makes you really tick, so to speak. And then it can make you hyper-focused on something. And what could that be? Well, for the chef, it was cooking. That could be gaming, that could be reading, that could be anything. There was a Nobel laureate in physics who was given the Nobel Prize, I think 2016, and he admitted that he had ADHD, and he was not very good at school. Yeah, he was a very good climber when he was young, so he was one of the best climbers in Europe, and he found his focus when he was rock climbing, and then he found his focus when he was doing physics, and he obviously became very, very good at that because he got the Nobel Prize. And I think that really shows that this has nothing to do about intelligence. There are no limits to what you can do if you have ADHD, not even attaining a Nobel Prize in physics. Of course, everyone can't do that, but everyone can't obtain a Nobel Prize in physics. I certainly can't. So what I mean by this is that it has nothing to do about being stupid.
But that seems to me that the life hack is to find something that's beneficial for you and that really interests you, right? Like this Nobel Prize winner and his climbing, or this guy who wasn't very good at school and had a drug addiction problem, but he found out he loves cooking and became an excellent chef.
Yeah, that exactly. And I mean, everyone should try to pursue their passions. That's important for everyone. But if you have these traits that we call ADHD, then that is very important. That's especially important, I think.
Are people with ADHD more likely to explore a lot of areas and a lot of different activities? Or do they have the chance to try a lot of new things? Because to me, ADHD is a little bit connected to procrastination as well. And these are, again, two completely different sides of one coin, right? To be able to be active or proactive and try a lot of new activities, and to be a little bit hesitant, procrastinating, not willing to go deeper into some activities. So it's a little bit confusing, honestly, to me.
It's definitely connected to exploring. And that's actually also some interesting genetic studies that shows that, I mean, humans originated from Africa. And when we left Eastern Africa about 60,000 years ago, and then we migrated all over Europe and then Asia and then over to the Americas, and it turns out that the further people have gone during 30,000 years, so the places in the world where people have moved the furthest during 30,000 years, in those places, this gene that is connected to ADHD is more common in the population. And that probably shows that some groups of humans always had this drive to, you know, I want to see what's behind the next river, behind the next mountain, let's go. And they continue going and going and going and going. And then groups branching off, some staying in one place, some moving further away. And then this goes on for generations after generations after generations. So that points to the fact that these individuals have probably been explorers. And that's why it's so interesting that ADHD traits, and especially this gene actually, is more common among entrepreneurs today. Entrepreneurs, they are the boundary breakers of today. You don't say in 2024, what's behind the next mountain? You say, I wonder if I could figure out a smarter way to do this on the phone, or create an app that does this or that, or a payment system or whatever. You know, that's breaking boundaries in our world. So I think definitely think that these people are explorers and inventors and entrepreneurs. About the procrastination, there are many discussions about that. And since these individuals seem to perceive the world as a bit more boring than the rest of us, maybe they procrastinate because they want to make the world more interesting. Because if you procrastinate until you just have a little time, well, then it becomes very exciting. You know, I have to do this now. I have to fix this. I just have 45 minutes. So maybe that, maybe what you're actually doing, what your brain is doing, is trying to make the world more interesting by creating this pressure on yourself. Of course, it's not a good thing to procrastinate. And my main advice there for people with ADHD is to break down things they need to do in smaller segments. Not say, okay, I will have this done by the end of the week. I say, I will have this done before lunch, and this before I'm finished today, and this tomorrow by lunch. Smaller, shorter segments.
This really reminds me of Elon Musk. I read his biography by Walter Isaacson during Christmas time. And there was many times written that he needed to create some sense of urgency within all of his companies. And he, some years ago, he admitted that he was diagnosed with ADHD and probably some, I'm not sure whether Asperger or something, but undiagnosed, he says. But this was very something very typical for him to set up an unrealistic deadline and then push everybody into fulfilling that. And once there is no imminent threat around, he started to get bored and needed to create some other sense of urgency that needs his immediate focus and attention. And he was able to hyper-focus on that. So this chapter that I read during Christmas really popped into my mind when you said it. But is this a positive trait? I understand that the willingness to take risks, to push the boundaries further, that is something that enables entrepreneurs to create new businesses, to even send people possibly one day to Mars, right? Which is something that Elon Musk is trying to do. But is this positive, or is this on a scale as well?
There are always two sides to the coin. So this can be fantastic. Of course, it can also be detrimental because it can lead to, for instance, abuse of different sorts. You're more susceptible and vulnerable to different forms of abuse. So there's always two sides to this coin. And that's why I think it's so important to learn about these differences, to understand them, to understand your vulnerabilities, your Achilles heels. If you learn about that rather early in life, you probably don't make as much mistakes. If I made a personality test, if I had done that, didn't do that, I would not have gone into economics, which I spent a couple of years on. It was just not for me. And I should have realized that. And maybe a personality test could have shown that. So I think, referring to your question, it can be both wonderful and it can be a disaster at the same time. But it's definitely good for the group to have these individuals in society who push boundaries. They are needed, because otherwise things will be very static. Having said that, everyone can't be that, because then it will be completely chaotic. So you need the ones who also say, wait a minute, be careful, be cautious. That's a functioning society. But when these individuals are growing up and feeling damaged, broken, then we lose something. And exactly the same thing goes for the ones with autism. They are very, very, very good at systematizing, figuring out how to manipulate systems. Perhaps they're not so interested in social relations. So that's why we often miss their talent. And I'm very much fond of this, what we call neurodiversity, the realization that there isn't one form of normal brain. Brains should be different. That's the big advantage. Humans did not conquer the planet because we are smarter than everyone else, or faster, or stronger, but as Yuval Harari points out, because we collaborate best in large groups. And when we do that, we use these differences in a productive way.
I'm going to be the devil's advocate here just for one more minute to ask the question. Don't you think that people sometimes misuse these diagnoses as an excuse for their maybe even toxic behavior? I remember one sketch from Saturday Night Live when Elon Musk said that to anyone I've offended, I'm sorry, but I reinvented the electric cars and I'm sending people to Mars. So do you think I would be a chill, normal dude?
This diagnosis is certainly not meant to be as an excuse, because, of course, there's still a part of us where we get to decide what we do. So you should not use them as that. And I have also many patients who think that they can understand their whole lives based on a diagnosis. And I think humans are always looking for a story that explains themselves. we're just wired that way. And to some, these diagnoses has become that story. And that's a shame because we are so incredibly complex. Everyone with ADHD is different. Everyone with autism is different. They have some things in common, but they're also very different. So you should not generalize too much. And you should certainly not use these things as an excuse for behaving sort of badly.
What are any other ADHD-related traits that really help entrepreneurs? Because when I was preparing or doing some research for these interviews, I really found actually long lists of famous entrepreneurs, either from the past, from Thomas Alva Edison to, I don't know, Elon Musk, as I said, or sportsman Michael Phelps, who is also diagnosed with ADHD. Do they have something else in common? Are there any other ADHD-related traits that enable them to become excellent in what they do?
That's a great question. Something that I have seen in a lot of patients, and I've not seen data on this, but I see that people with ADHD often, they rise. They don't get pushed down for too long. If they have problems in lives, they don't get, you know, bogged down from it. They try again and again and again and again. It's like this doll that you can't push over. It sort of goes up again. And they, regardless of how many setbacks they have, they continue to fight. And I remember there was a patient that I wrote about in this book, and her life was just a roller coaster ride. She had experienced more when she was 25 than most people experience in a lifetime. Including a jail sentence and severe abuse and also big successes. And if I had experienced that in that age, I would be hiding under the blanket for a couple of years. I would be totally knocked out. And I was just surprised that she managed to shake these things off. And that is very important. I think any entrepreneur will agree that their success story was not a straight line. It was not just one good thing after the other. It was a lot of setbacks. And it was the fact that they just continued and continued and continued that in the end made all the difference. And as a psychiatrist, that ability to rise and not get knocked down, that is something that I see in a lot of people with ADHD.
Is there a sort of a job that would be ideal for people with ADHD? Or is there some sort of environment that would comfort these people? For instance, when I was reading about entrepreneurs in your book, you mentioned that a lot of these people did quit their corporate jobs, which they found boring. Right. And many people without ADHD find these jobs boring. So I must just imagine how boring they are to people who need different levels of dopamine. And that's why they took the entrepreneurial path. And is there a certain sort of a job that would fit them more or that would be something totally unacceptable for them?
I think it's hard to generalize too much because everyone with ADHD is different. So it's very hard to say that one pattern is good. Obviously, being a Nobel level physicist is different from being a chef, is different from being an entrepreneur and so on. But in general, I would say you should try to be in a surrounding where things are happening fast and not so static. So perhaps working in auditing is perhaps not a good thing, you know, something which is very fixed to a system and very, very bound to routines. And that is perhaps not so good. I think maybe sales these things or working as a chef or working as an entrepreneur and so on. But remember, everyone is different. So don't take this too seriously. You have to find out what you like and you should pursue that because you really need to find your passion. And when you find that, you will hyper-focus on it.
What about authorities?
I think that many of these people don't work out so well in strictly hierarchical situations where, you know, there's just office politics that is important. I think these individuals are often very practical. You know, the best idea is the best idea. It doesn't care where it came from. So this internal office politics, that's not very suited for most of these individuals.
Do people with ADHD make good leaders?
Some of them do, of course, but it's also very hard to generalize. I don't know whether Elon Musk is a good leader. He certainly pushes people, so he gets a lot of things done. Maybe his employees thinks it's a bit too much. So I think it's hard to generalize, actually.
I also wanted to ask you, what is the connection between ADHD and addiction? Since you, on the story of the Swedish chef, you also mentioned that he was using drugs and abusing them. You also mentioned the story of a woman who was in prison for drugs, I believe. So is this something common? Is there a threat that ADHD can lead people toward this path? Are they more prone to be addicted to something? Not necessarily drugs, but what is the correlation?
There's definitely a bigger risk of developing addiction if you have ADHD. What I think you're doing is sort of self-medicating. I have seen so many patients with ADHD who have tried amphetamines, and they did not get high from it or speedy. They got very calm, and they realized, wow, I can focus now. And actually, the most common medicines that are used to treat ADHD are closely related to amphetamines. The expression self-medication is sometimes used to excuse yourself. So that's a bit difficult to talk about. But these people are more prone to different forms of addictions. They're more vulnerable to that. And not just substance abuse, but gaming addictions, for instance. And also actually extreme sport seems to be more common among these people. And I think what they are looking for is they have this reward system in the brain, which works a bit differently, and that need more stimuli to work properly. And of course, drugs increases the activity in the reward system. And drugs is not a good way to do that. Then it's much better to find what makes you tick. So, but you have to be aware that you are vulnerable to different forms of addiction.
What about workaholism?
That's too, it's a form of an addiction that is more common among these individuals. They can be both bad and good. You could get a lot of things done. Is it good for your mental health? Well, not always, I guess. So the trick is always know yourself, I think, and understand yourself better. And that's very, very difficult because we don't see ourselves as we are. We see ourselves the way the brain wants to show ourselves, which is with a lot of biases. So as a psychiatrist, I get more and more, I understand how little of ourselves that we know. How much of our mental landscape, which is under our radar. And that's why it's so important to learn about these things. And you have to not learn about them once. You have to learn about them several times, about personality, about ADHD, about etc. And then when you read about this, when you hear about this, eventually you start seeing it in yourself. And you realize that, wow, this is how I work. And then you could sort of understand your Achilles heels better and work your way around them.
So we spoke a lot about the positive aspects of ADHD and the related traits on the scale. We also spoke about the negatives and the dangers and the vulnerabilities that these people have. Let's talk a little bit about the treatment, either medical or non-medical. And my first question would be, how should I know when should I seek out a medical professional?
Well, you should seek out help if it causes problems in your life, if there are things you want to do that you can't do because of this. ADHD is not something temporary. It's not something that you get. It's something that you had your whole life. And if you don't know whether you should seek out help, I think you should seek out help and then let someone professional decide what kind of help is good for you. And when it comes to ADHD, in Sweden at least, it's not a diagnosis that you put immediately. You do a number of tests and you have to do some hours of interviews with a psychologist. And then eventually you get a diagnosis. And why isn't it put immediately, like being diagnosed with anxiety? Well, that's because it's difficult to distinguish between what's normal problems with focus and what is ADHD. That big gray zone makes it difficult to draw a line. And that's why you do these rather big investigations, actually.
What kind of questions do you ask people when they come into your office during these interviews?
Well, I ask them for always if their teachers that remember them, how they remember them. Are you the one who, you know, was running around and in your classroom, the one who always stood out? That's a question I always ask men, but for women, ADHD, the hyperactivity is often not so pronounced. It's more about not focusing so much. They are sitting still, but they can't focus. So then I ask them how they the memories from school. I always emphasize, how is this a problem in your life? What kind of problems does it cause? If it doesn't cause any problems, it's not a psychiatric diagnosis. And I make sure that they don't seek an explanation for why their lives became in a certain way, because personality is so complex, you can't really say that with a diagnosis. A diagnosis should just be there to guide treatment, not to give an explanation or a story that explains your life.
Do you have an answer to the question why women and men with ADHD behave differently? Because this is very interesting, as you said, that women are usually, let's say, still and don't run around, or young girls, and the itch to move or the itch to do something else is usually in their brain, not to do it with their body. So do you have an answer to that question?
No, that's more boys are being diagnosed with ADHD than girls. Perhaps it's 2 boys to 1 girl, or even 3 boys to 1 girl. Does that mean that ADHD is more common in boys? Well, that's a big discussion. Maybe it's just that we are not finding the girls. Maybe there's a lot of girls who don't get diagnosed because they don't run around in the classroom, so they are not being discovered. I lean towards that, actually, that there are many who are not discovered yet. Why, you know, these differences exist, I'm not sure. But the brains of men and women are not identical. There are some differences, rather small, but they do exist. So it's probably boils down to biology in the end, I think.
When do you decide to prescribe someone medication for ADHD? How bad does it need to be?
Yeah, so if they have been diagnosed, many wants to try medication, and then normally we try that. And the medicines are amphetamine-based, or you don't give them in such a high dose that you can get high on them. And you must monitor blood pressure, and you must monitor other side effects. They can cause anxiety, they can cause problems with your stomach. So I often try that, and for some patients, they work great, and for other people, they don't work so great. These medicines affect dopamine in our brains, and dopamine system is often, but not always, the reason why people have ADHD. But if it's not, then the medicines will not work. My personal estimate is that they work for about 60 to 70% of the people with ADHD, but not for everyone. You should remember that it's not just medicine. You also have to make lifestyle changes. We know, for instance, that exercise is incredibly important for focus, especially for people with ADHD. When children with ADHD exercise before school, they have been shown to be able to reduce the dose of their ADHD medication. They can't take away the medication, but they can reduce the dose. So exercise is incredibly important. And I think also it's important to break down tasks into smaller things, so that you don't say this should be done by the end of the week. You say this should be done by the end of the hour. And again, find your passion. Find the things you really tick for. And, you know, find the stuff that brings you hyper-focus and go for it.
I'm going to ask openly, do you think that the ADHD medication is over-prescribed? That there is too much, kids, adolescents, adults on medication when they don't necessarily need to be? Because also in your book, you read that if 5% of people are diagnosed with ADHD, almost half of them should be or could be manageable without medication, if I got that correctly.
That's a very difficult question. If I have to answer that, I would say yes, I think they are being used too much. And I think the focus is just on medicines. And the problem is that the ones with most severe problems, they end up, you know, not getting help, because they are the ones, they can't manage time, so they miss their appointment and stuff like that. And if you miss your appointment and you have a diagnosis that 10% of the population has, well, then, you know, you're not going to get any help. So that's the main drawback. And of course, also the medicines can have side effects, and you must monitor them very carefully. You must monitor blood pressure. And if so many people are being prescribed this, this doesn't function. But it's actually a very difficult question, because if the medicines help for the ones who really need help, they can be life-changing. So to anyone who listens, if you're not sure whether you should seek help or not, seek help and then let someone else decide what kind of help is best for you.
When I was looking for a silver lining between all of the books we published from you, physical movement and sport has been one thing that really popped up. And also in this book about ADHD, you were writing elaborately about how physical activity can improve and how can it have positive impact on your brain and how it can increase your dopamine levels. So is it in general? Is it a different or a certain type of physical activity? And how long do you need to do something with your body so that you can feel the positive aspects?
What's so interesting about physical activity is that the brain counts every step. 5 minutes of walking is better than nothing. So every physical activity is good for the brain. When it comes to increasing your focus, if you have ADHD, you should try to raise your pulse for at least 30 minutes. That's the ideal. Whatever you will do, if you play tennis or run or cross-country ski or whatever you want to do, play, that's fine. What counts is the intensity of the activity. And by intensity, I mean how much your heart rate increases, basically. If you can't do that, you probably get some benefit from just having a walk or something like that. So my main message about physical activity is that's something that humans have evolved for. That's incredibly important, not just for our bodies, but for our brains. And it increases all of our cognitive functions. It improves our ability to focus. It improves our creativity. It improves our even intelligence, it actually seems. It improves our mood. It protects against depressions. And we should not mix physical activity with being good at a sport. Exercise has nothing to do about being the ones who's picked for the soccer team or the one who does X hours on the marathon. Exercise is something that we should try to build into our lives.
I remember that I read in your book about Michael Phelps, who we mentioned already in this podcast before, and there was a chapter about how he couldn't sit still during a classroom and how he wasn't interested in mathematics. But once he started counting and measuring the lengths in the pool that he swam or to time his records or something, that he really became focused on it and interested in it.
Yes, exactly. And for many, if it's not too abstract, it becomes concrete. How, in what way should I use this? Then it becomes interesting enough. But what is striking as a psychiatrist is that many people who have ADHD, they are very physically active. And I have seen many times people who get injured for one reason or another, perhaps a knee or something, and then they can't be physically active. And then you see their ability to focus drops. And the boost in focus that they have been gaining from physical activity, when they don't get that, they start wondering, do I have ADHD? And what they have probably done is they have managed these symptoms. They have realized that they can manage it by physical activity. Perhaps they haven't made that connection consciously, but maybe that's why they've been so driven to do it. And I think that it's no coincidence that many sports stars have said that they have ADHD. Maybe they have been driven by this effect that they get from exercise on their mood and on their focus. Maybe that's what's been driving them so hard the whole time. And I think that these individuals have probably, during our history, been hunters, stuff like that. You know, they were constantly active, constantly scanning the surroundings, constantly moving. That's the biology that they have evolved for. And that's the biology that they are sort of mimicking when they are exercising today.
Do you think this could be somehow translated into our educational systems? I know that when we spoke last year, you mentioned that in Sweden there is an increased amount of physical education at schools because it has been shown that it reduces anxiety and so on. And I just remembered that I have a quote from one American doctor, Michael Anderson, that you actually write in your book that as a society, we decided that it is too costly to fix the environment for the children. So we fix the children instead. So my question would be, do you think it is possible to fix the environment? I know that you are not an educational expert, but since it has so positive benefits...
I certainly think that would help a lot. And when we did this TV series, we went to a school in southern Sweden and they have extra physical activity on their curriculum. These students were between 13 and 16 and they had big social problems in this area. And there was a lot of students who did not finish the ninth grade, which is high school, I think is comparable to. without being approved in all the subjects. They had big problems with that. So they say, okay, let's do something. And then they added extra physical activity. And they had that 3 times a week, 25 minutes every time, pulse racing. The students should increase their pulse to 70% of their maximum pulse. It was no competition. There was nothing like, you know, being soccer or something like that. They could choose what they wanted to do, but they had to raise their pulse. And they even switched the gym teachers so that they would not feel pressure to perform to get a good grade in gym. And this went on, and the amount of people who finished the ninth grade, who passed all the subjects, more than doubled after a year. And I went to visit them, and I said to the headmasters, there were two of them, that, okay, you did more than this. You did not just increase this amount of physical activity, but you also made other changes in school. So how do you know what comes from the physical activity and what doesn't? And they said, we don't know that. We did not make a study. We did this to change a real thing. But they thought that the physical activity was the most important part. And what was so striking was not the fact that they wanted to talk about how much better the children were in school, how much better they were performing. They wanted to talk about the mental health for the children. They thought that the children were so much happier, so much less anxious, and less depressed, actually. And that's exactly what science has shown, that exercise has these effects. So I think from a school setting, we must build in more physical activity, not necessarily by having more hours of football, but perhaps walking to school or riding your bike to school or handling in your screen and playing during lunch break instead of staring at the screen and so on and so forth.
And this is something that we don't need someone to do it for us, right? We don't need someone to tell us to just start walking to school or to where these are small changes that we can implement ourselves.
Exactly. And these headmasters, I asked them, so you gave these children 3 times 25 minutes every week extra physical activity. You have classes in that. Did that mean that you took away history class or math class or something? And they said, no, we made it mandatory, but we put it outside the schedule. Okay, I said, so that means that these children go to school for 2 hours longer every week. And they said, yes. And they said, take it or leave it. This is how we do it at this school. And I thought that was fabulous. It had these effects. Let's do it. Let's not wait for the authorities to do this. Let's do it ourselves.
Let's wrap it up with some practical tips for our listeners and readers. My first question regarding the tips would be, what should we do if we have ADHD or if we think that we score higher on the scale? What small changes could we benefit from?
My main advice is learn more about this. Learn more about ADHD and how it functions. Then you will become kinder to yourself. So you will certainly become kinder to others in the environment. And one advice might be to break things, tasks up to smaller parts, but really make an effort to try to find the things that makes you hyper-focus. You should try to find your passion. And of course, to exercise, try to do that every day because that will improve your focus the hour after exercise. But apart from that, I think it's very hard to give advice that are too general. I mean, everyone with ADHD is different. So therefore, I say to learn more about this and learn about it through several books and several talks and read from it from many ways, and eventually you would see being played out in yourself.
So if we want to support our close ones, we should try to find out more about ADHD, probably read your book.
And there are several good books about this, but I wanted to emphasize this evolutionary perspective because I don't want people to feel damaged or broken. They are functioning differently. That doesn't mean that they are broken. They are just being told that they're broken by modern society and modern school system because they are not really built for that. But these traits have been vital for our survival in our history, and they are still vital, and they still come with advantages. But those advantages are perhaps not so evident when you're young.
What is the one thing that people should remember from this podcast if they return back to their everyday lives, continue with their work tasks, and they want to have one memory or one memorable thing that they can go back into or discuss in the evening at home, what should that be?
I think it would be the thing I said at last, that ADHD is not the disease, but it's not something that is made up. It's a number of traits that have helped humans to survive, and it's a number of traits which we all may owe our lives to. Otherwise, humans may not have even left Africa. It's a number of traits that has big advantages in today's society as well, but that comes with certain vulnerabilities. And if we are aware about those, then we could sort of build our way around these Achilles heels. And the more also we learn about them, the less we will look at ourselves as broken and understand that we are functioning differently. We're not damaged. We're just different.
What are you working on in the future? What topics are there left for you to explore? So what are you working on next?
I haven't decided really. I work as a clinician now. I'm focusing on that, on my patients. And then I have a study at the Karolinska where we look at how cognition is affected by physical exercise for patients with schizophrenia. We've had a number of patients with schizophrenia who exercise regularly, and we've done a number of cognitive tests on them before and after that, and we've done a number of blood tests. We will analyze these results. So that's what I'm currently focusing about. I think I will write something, but I haven't decided. I don't like to, you know, chase subjects and see, oh, what's the next thing for book? I let the subjects come to me. And if they're interesting enough, I write it. If I don't, I don't. So I don't feel any pressure.
That's amazing. Fingers crossed. We look forward to it already.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anders.
Thank you.
This has been lovely as the last time.
Toto bol švédsky psychiater Anders Hansen. Moje meno je Lucia Okšová a túto špeciálnu epizódu podcastu Nevyhorený vám prináša Forbes Slovensko. Novú knihu Andersa Hansena Dobrá správa o ADHD si môžete zakúpiť na webe Forbesu. Link nájdete v popise podcastu a vo vybraných kníhkupectvách. Ďakujeme, že nás počúvate.
Je vôbec niečo také ako univerzálny recept na úspech? Čo sú vlastnosti, ktoré vám pomôžu preraziť? A dá sa to stihnúť ešte pred 30-tkou? Moje meno je Simona Gulišová, som redaktorkou magazínu Forbes a tieto otázky zodpovieme v podcaste Forbes 30 po 30 s mojimi hostiami každý druhý útorok. Sú mladí, sú úspešní a sú dôkazom, že aj zo Slovenska sa dajú robiť svetové veci. Naladte sa s nami na poriadnu dávku inšpirácie v podaní súčasných, aj bývalých členov prestížneho rebríčka Forbes 30 po 30 a ďalších ľudí, ktorých mená rezonujú od biznisu až po šport. Vypočujte si, ako otvorene hovoria o svojej ceste za úspechom, ktorá je neraz poznačená aj pádmi. A inšpirujte sa ich tipmi, ktoré vám pomôžu naštartovať úspešnú kariéru či biznis a dodajú vám nádej, koľko mladých talentov máme na Slovensku. Predstavujem vám podcast Forbes 30 po 30.